Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I've got a real cool guest today. I am just back from NAMM. It's Monday. It's sunny. I went to the gym. I feel good. This guy is a great-looking guy. He looks like he's about 25, Jeremy Asbrock. A couple of quick messages. Number one, I want to give a shout-out to our mutual friend Joe Pisapia for connecting us. Thank you, Joe, right on. And
thanks, Joe.
Also, yeah, great guy. And also make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the show on both the YouTube channel and the audio. And Carlos Santana, Joe Walsh, if you can connect me with them, please do so. I'd love to have those guys on my show. Let's move on to my man, Jeremy. Jeremy Asbrock, native of the Nashville area. After becoming obsessed with the song Dreamweaver at age two. I remember that song was so great, man. It's a good song to become obsessed with. This is old school. You don't hear this. He bought his first Kiss record, side 3 and 4 of Alive 2 from a neighbor.
Hang on, check this out.
Yeah. That was so cool. Yeah, there you go. Oh, now you got this an autograph by the whole band. But that was so cool.
The whole band except Paul Stanley. He's always so tough.
To get autographs? Why is that?
I don't know, man. My path just doesn't cross with him as much as the other guys.
Paul, if you're listening, send Jeremy a damn autograph. Come on, man. Hook a brother up. But how funny is that? You didn't buy the whole record. You bought side 3 and 4.
Well, the way that happened is it's also, I was 4 years old also when that happened. So the kid that lived behind us came out with both records without the gatefold cover. It was like, hey, man, I'll sell you these for 50 cents a piece. And me and my brother ran in and asked mom for 50 cents. And she's like, well, you can buy one. And we went back out, and my brother said, get that one. It has Shout It Out Loud. Okay. And of course, that was the first song we put on. And I mean, you know, for everybody that knows that, the crowd is like 1,000 tracks of screaming people. Ah! And then the bombs go off, and man, my fate was sealed forever.
There you go, man. This immediately set a path off, as you can hear, of blind obsession to rock and roll guitar specifically and Kiss. He then discovered the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, and Aerosmith catalogs, which really started shaping the player he is today. Jeremy took lessons until age 14, and then he started playing in clubs at 16. He spent the next 15 years with a band called The Shazam. They had a really successful year in England, which included TV and radio appearances from Abbey Road Studios. And they were billed between Duran Duran and Paul Weller. How the hell were you playing loud rock and roll in between Duran Duran and Paul Weller?
It was an acoustic set.
Oh, okay.
And also, man, we were like kind of a Beatle-y type thing. So we had a soft side as well as a hard rock side.
Right on. Yeah, I could see like a loud rock and roll band completely dominating that show between Duran Duran and Paul Weller. And they were featured heavily on Little Steven's Underground Garage. The band released several records, and this experience helped hone Jeremy into the player he is today. When that slowed down, Jeremy met Ryan Cook. Was he wearing the bunny suit at the time when you first met him?
He was not.
He was not. Okay, for the record. And Ryan invited him to join his 80s metal jukebox band, which was called Big Rock Show. They were on the first Kiss cruise 2 months later, and Big Rock Show wound up doing the next 8 Kiss cruises, leading to Gene Simmons hiring them and asking Ryan to put together a band to tour with Gene, and that was that. Jeremy spent 2 years as one of Gene Simmons' guitar players. Then during a tour of Australia, they played a set with Ace Frehley and then a set with Gene. And then the band headed over to Japan to do a week's worth of shows as Ace's backing band. At that point, Ace then asked them to stay on permanently. Jeremy's been with Ace Frehley for 1.5 years now. He also has a solo on Ace's upcoming record called Origins Volume 2, and he'll be touring with Ace this year. Dates to be announced soon. During this time, Jeremy also started a residency with Philip Schaus. Philip was a great guy. He was on this show earlier. Really good guitar player, really interesting guy. This was in Nashville, and these guys have what's called the Rock and Roll Residency, and this has been going on for 5 years. They play everything from 70s AM radio to early 80s British metal. The show's had tons of really cool guests, including Alice Cooper, Robin Zander, Roger Glover and Don Airey from Deep Purple, Gene Simmons, of course, and many others. Jeremy also toured as John Corabi's guitarist in support of Motley 94. Jeremy feels really grateful to be the guitar player for the two guys who got him into music, which is Gene Simmons and Ace Frehley. Dude, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
And it's kind of amazing, like when I hear all of that back, you know, like the condensed version of my life, I'm like, oh, my life's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool, right? Yeah. I like when people tell me that, because it's nice to watch you feel that, man, because you know it's a hard work and you don't usually sit and measure stuff. So that's cool, man. 15 years with the Shazam, that's a really long time for a band. How did you do so well in England, and I guess ultimately what happened that the band ended?
Okay, well, the band didn't end. The band is actually still together, sort of. I'll get to that. I sort of worked my way up the ranks in the band. I just started out as band best friend, head cheerleader, because I loved them. I thought they had everything that I was into musically, like all the right 60s influences and 70s influences. And, you know, they made their first record, and it was like a power pop trio. And then by the time the second record came around, I thought I wanted to be an engineer and producer at the time. So I was interning at the studio where their producer worked, and the studio that he owned. And
was this in Nashville?
Yes. Brad Jones at Alex the Great Studio. So I don't know, that stuff was a little more developed and just kind of required an extra musician and vocalist. And I was already band best friend and had toured with them. So I started playing with them. I wasn't even really in the band, but I was. So I hung out. I don't know. I was just around for the next 15 years.
Did they ever come and actually ever make an official say, hey, you're a member of the band?
Yes.
They did.
I'd say around 2003, I gave my life to the band.
Okay.
I signed my soul over to them. So we put out a few records. We worked with Mac, who engineered and mixed all that ELO stuff that everybody knows and loves. Produced all the Queen records from The Game until Kind of Magic. I don't know, that list gets real long. He worked in this studio in Germany called Music Land, and I mean, Led Zeppelin did Presence there. He engineered on that. Rolling Stones, Black and Blue.
Wow,
he engineered and mixed 20th Century Boy by T-Rex. Give Us a Wink by Sweet, Rainbow, Whitesnake, and Billy Squier. He produced the stuff that everybody loves by Billy Squier. That was a great experience to work with somebody who, you know, produced music that made us want to make music.
What label were you guys on?
It was a super independent label called Not Lame Records.
That's interesting that they just threw a lot of money at you, though.
No, not at all.
But to get a top tier
for any money.
But to get that guy,
man, Mac worked with us because he wanted to. We kind of brought him out of retirement.
Oh, wow.
We had a mutual friend. We had actually recorded the record that we did with him already, and we were just looking for somebody to mix. and a friend hooked us up together, and he didn't really want to mix somebody else's work. He wanted to start from scratch. So we spent the next year kind of refining everything and scraping up the funds to do it. And,
wow.
And it was super shoestring. Yeah, there was never any money, and the band got turned down by every major label for some reason. And I don't know, man, it just kind of slowed down after that. And, you know, Hans, he was the founder of the band. He kind of wanted to resume as a three-piece. And I don't know, man, I had a lot more to do. And that's when Philip and I started doing tribute bands and fun stuff together, which evolved into the Rock and Roll Residency. And, you know, Hans still writes and makes music. There's still actually about 2 Shazam albums in the can. We lost our drummer last year, so that definitely slowed things up.
Oh, wow. Sorry, man.
Oh, that's okay. And, you know, the band will still exist somehow. We did a show last year. I'll probably play bass and the drummer will play drums. You know, it'll stay alive somehow. But, yeah, and then just after that, I don't know, it just kind of started following my path wherever it took me.
How did you guys get so big in England?
So there was a label called Rainbow Quartz, and the guy just had a bunch of power pop bands. For those of you who don't know what power pop is, I don't know. It's just kind of Beatles, Cheap Trick, you know, mid to late 60s British sounding kind of music. A bunch of those type of bands, and he put out all the records, and radio bit, and the people liked it. And I don't know, man, it was just kind of one of those snowball things that happened. We went over, wow, it's been 20 years ago in 2 weeks. And,
program
directors from one of the BBC stations was a big Move fan. He loved it. We went back over in March, and then he saw us again. And then they were doing that thing at Abbey Road in May and brought us over for that, billed us really high on that. And then Paul Weller sat in the control room at Abbey Road and watched us and loved the band. So he had us open his Earl's Court show that November. And it was just like this huge snowball thing that happened really fast. And then the next year, the White Stripes and the Strokes came in and everybody forgot about this.
Wow. Yeah, man. I hear this, unfortunately, a lot. Well, any cool memories from Abbey Road Studios itself, the actual experience of working there?
All of it. Yeah. I got to play the Penny Lane piano. We got to go in the echo chamber where they would go hang out and smoke cigarettes and jazz cigarettes. you know, just going into Studio 2, walking up those steps. I mean, we were the last people to leave, and they had to ask us to leave because they wanted to lock up. And it was an all-day thing, too. There were a lot of bands on the bill that day. Just, yeah, man. Like, I get goosebumps thinking about it. Like, everybody that goes to England will go get their photo made on the steps or walk by it.
In the crosswalk, like, yeah.
When you can walk through that door, like, oh, my God, I'm inside. This is where it all went down.
Do they still have some of, like, the amps that the Beatles use, or they set aside, maybe, or?
I didn't see any amps. I saw lots of microphones. I saw the 8-track console, because at that time they were remixing and remastering the anthologies for DVD. Mm-hmm. This was 2000. So the console was in there, not the 4-track one, but the 8-track one.
That's cool, man.
So the one that they did Abbey Road on.
That's very cool. So once the Shazam started to wind down, if you had to look back, what were some maybe like lessons that you learned that you were able to take with you, whether it's musically, performance, entertainment, business-wise, you know, whatever sticks out to you?
Well, business-wise, it was definitely pay more attention to it.
Pay more attention to business in general.
Yes. Man, the band was just always broke. I don't know, but when you're trying to get there and you're making the music, it's hard to think about that, because now I can look back at it and see it. But when you're inside of it, it's just hard to pay attention to it, because you're so into the making of the music. And, you know, when you're touring, getting to the next city and playing the show, and I don't, So paying attention to it is definitely one thing.
Do you do that now? Are you better at that now?
Absolutely. Cool. I don't really play in a band like that anymore. I generally play for artists.
Right.
And, you know, the only thing similar to that is the Rock and Roll Residency. And yes, Philip and I have definitely done a way better job of managing that situation than any of us did in the Shazam. It wasn't anybody's fault. You just kind of learn that stuff as you go.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
I don't know if it's necessarily a lesson that I learned, but it's just that, you know, you're with anything you do, there's going to be failures, there's going to be setbacks, and it's just to stay positive and stay focused and believe that, you know, whatever you're trying to achieve is going to happen. I always thought I would be in my band and that's how I would have made it and how I'd make my living. And turns out that's not really the case, that I'm going to be a sideman. Even with the Shazam, I was still a sideman.
Yeah.
That was never my plan. It just happened that way. And you know what, man, that's okay.
Just, hey, if this gives you comfort, 90% of the people I've had, 90% of the guests that have been kind enough to come here on the show have literally the exact same. I always thought I'd be, and then you realize, wow, that the likelihood to be in a successful sideman is so small, but being a, you know, so everybody has that same, you know, sort of progression and understanding of, well, if I want to make a living playing guitar, these are the options.
And, you know, like I said, I never planned on that. That was never my plan. But if it was going to happen, being Gene Simmons and Ace Frehley's guitar player, the two guys that made me want to play guitar in the first place, it's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, they ain't a bad deal. Right, right, man. Right on. Once the Shazam was sort of over, you said it was kind of at the same time that you met Philip.
Well, no, actually, I met Philip because he read about the Shazam in a British magazine.
That's wild.
And I was like, what? There's a band like that from Nashville? And he was living in Alabama. So
he's from Alabama, right? Isn't that where he's from?
Yeah, he's kind of from Midwest. But, you know, his family wound up in Alabama, and that's where he went to high school. And, grew up from a teenager on. He read about us and came to our next show. This is where the whole Kiss connection gets super crazy. And he stood in the front row and he had a Kiss Love Gun shirt on. And I saw him. I'm like, man, that dude sure is cool. I'm going to talk to that guy after the show. And I met him that night and it was kind of like meeting yourself.
That's funny, and, man.
We stayed friends, and just over the next couple of years, we got closer and closer. And then I hooked him up with a friend of mine, playing guitar for his band, and he moved to Nashville, and I mean, he's been my best friend for about 20 years now.
Dude, that's really cool. That's a nice story. Thank you for sharing that, man.
I would love to go back in time and tell us what's going to happen.
But it may not happen if you tell you. True. You know? I had this conversation with my wife yesterday. Yeah, you have to give up something to go back.
It's true.
Yeah. But it's a good thought, though. Tell me, for people that don't know, tell them about the Rock and Roll Residency and what you guys do there, because it's a really cool thing.
Okay, so it started because in April of 2014, we both had an empty calendar. And it's like, shit, let's figure out something. And at that point, we had a few tribute bands together. We had a Kiss tribute band we did every Christmas for charity. We had done an Aerosmith tribute band. We had done like a all-encompassing metal tribute thing, like Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, stuff like that. We had a Thin Lizzy tribute band. So we had all these catalogs of songs that we could draw from. It's like, hey man, let's try a weekly thing. And just, you know, we can pull from all of our tribute bands. And So we went to a bar called Dan McGinnis, which was right on the edge of Music Row. And that was the first place we went, and they bit. Like, we didn't even have to go anywhere else. And We had a Chuck Garrett from the Alice Cooper band. He was our first bass player. And at that point it was called It's Only Rock and Roll Tuesday.
Okay.
And that month went really, really well. And they asked us to stay. And Philip was touring at the time with a country artist named Rodney Atkins. And Chuck was about to leave for the Motley Crue Alice Cooper tour. So Philip brought in the bass player from the Rodney Atkins band because, you know, their schedules would have been synced up. And it's like, okay, well, other than a few holes from touring, you know, yeah, we can do this. And we stayed there for the next 3 years, and they started getting noise complaints at Music Row,
which is funny.
So we wound up moving to the Mercy Lounge, which is an actual, you know, music venue, and then we stayed there until the end of 2018. And we kind of had to wrap up the weekly free shows because, you know, we were touring with Gene a lot, and it just, you can't tell people that you have a weekly show if you only play 26 weeks out of a 52 week year.
Sure.
And, you know, we have a lot of rock and roll friends in town, you know, like a lot of people have moved here over the past few years and we're like, hey man, we can have, you know, all our new friends come out and guest with us and it'll be fun. And you know what, man, let's just play whatever we want. You know, most cover bands like cater to an audience and, you know, so that means most cover bands generally have the same set list. And this wasn't about that because they asked us to stay and we were already playing whatever we want. So our thing was more playing the other songs, you know,
like deep tracks.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool.
So, you know, like where if you're going to play a Deep Purple song, most people would play Smoke on the Water or something, right. You know, you play, you know, Highway Star or Bloodsucker or something like that. And man, more and more people just kept coming. And then our audience started to develop relationships with each other, you know, like everybody made new friends. People found band members, you know, people that had grudges and stuff buried the hatchet, you know, people met and fell in love and had children. I watched all of this stuff happen and it just went, became more than a show. It was a community.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's the happiest accident that ever happened to me. And I've gotten to jam with, you know, like Roger and Don from Deep Purple, you know, Robin Zander came out one night. It's like, holy shit, man, Robin Zander's here. And it's like, hey man, you want to do something with us? He's like, yeah, sure. What do you want to do? He's like, let's do Long Way to the Top. It's like, okay.
That's wild. Like, I think, man, he lives down here.
Can we do a Cheap Trick song? And it's like, yeah, what do you want to do? I'm like, let's do He's a Whore. And it's like, sure. That was an amazing night. So he came out, and then we had Roger and Don the next 2 weeks, and then Robin came out again the next week after that. So that was a good month. That was February of 2016. That was a great month.
Any other cool stories, like, of interesting artists that came on?
So Alice was the first one. We didn't actually get to play with Alice. That had kind of been arranged by Chuck way in advance.
Right.
He knew that when Motley Crue and Alice came here, they were going to have a day off the next day. So he had kind of arranged to have a thing that night, the night of the show. So we did our show like we normally do. And then Alice's band showed up and they did a 5-song set, and then Alice showed up and they did a few songs, and then Alice hightailed out of there, and then we resumed our show after that.
Wow, that's a nice
So basically, you know, like the Alice Cooper band did a small little set at our show. That was cool. That was all Chuck, man. He gets all the credit for that.
Very cool.
Except too, the Except band. That was the only other time we let a band take over our stage. Christopher Williams, who's their drummer now, that was his first performance with Accept. You know, all of those guys are based in Nashville, and, you know, he was too, and he was the new drummer. So we just let them take the stage and do a couple songs with him.
That's cool, man. I still remember buying that Restless and Wild record like 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah, we've done that song quite a few times.
That was pretty earth shattering at the time. That was pretty heavy for those days, man.
It was heavy.
You know,
it's kind of funny. You listen to it now and it just sounds like rock and roll.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, sure. I had Bruce Kulick on the show here quite some time ago, and he mentioned how he learned so much from working with Gene. I was curious what are, you know, not necessarily related to music, just about business, life, marketing, et cetera. I was curious, what are the top two or three things that you might have picked up from Gene along the way?
More of the pay attention to business stuff. Gene definitely, you know, I was already working my way out of just the music box, and Gene definitely enhanced that to open yourself up to things other than music as means of income. You know,
so you're licensing Jeremy bobbleheads?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a master of licensing, man.
You know, there's a small difference between me and Bruce. You know, I started playing with Gene when I was 42. And, you know, Bruce was a little bit younger, so
yeah.
You know, I don't know how much Bruce had done in the way of playing big audiences and stuff like that. And I'd already done some of that stuff. What else did I learn from Gene? Might have to come back to that.
All good, man. All good. Tell me top three experiences you've had musically.
Okay. The Abbey Road thing definitely sits in the top three. The whole Gene Simmons experience sits in the top three. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. Cause that was only supposed to be six shows for these Comic-Con type things. And we wound up, you know, touring the world. So I got to go to Japan and South America and Mexico and Europe. And, one experience in particular was when we went to Bolivia and when we got off the plane and walked into the airport, man, there were about 300 people there going nuts. It was like Beatles stuff. It was complete mayhem.
Bolivia,
you can look on all of our Instagrams and see the video footage we all filmed coming out. It was insane. I couldn't believe it, to be able to like see that through that lens.
And all three of you guys are on that tour, three guitar players.
Yes.
That's so wild that he's got three guitar players, man.
Okay, so that happened because initially Gene was only going to sing. He wasn't going to play bass. So we were just going to pass around a bass.
Oh, so one night you take it, one night Ryan, and one take. Oh,
good sense prevailed. And just kind of the way our pay was structured, it didn't really matter to Gene. And he wound up falling in love with the three guitar thing. He thought it sounded symphonic, like having, you know, a few cellos and stuff, to the point where he would have us start every song together, and instead of like layering like you would think you would do with three guitars, he liked it where you had three guitars just punching you. And also that allowed for, you know, good backup vocals too, because we all sing.
Oh, that's great. And you guys have played together for so long that you had this chemistry that it wasn't like you just picked, okay, here's these three random guys.
Yes. And we were all friends first, where, you know, most of the time where you're put in a situation with other musicians playing for somebody, you know, your friendship develops because you were all put together.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like that, man. Like we were friends who all went on this adventure together. And that's why, like, our chemistry thing is probably a little stronger than most bands, because we are friends first.
That's cool.
It is, man. I can't ask for a cooler experience. It's actually perfect.
Tell me number three. Abbey Road, Gene Simmons experience. What was number three?
Man, I'm probably leaving something out, but, you know, Ace asking me to play a solo on his new album. I mean, I play guitar because of the guy. And for him to let me do that, I mean, he certainly doesn't need somebody to play a solo on his album.
Yeah, that was very cool.
You know, I guess that is sort of coupled with, you know, being able to have a relationship with those two guys. Like I can text them and they'll text me back. And,
sure.
You know, for 4-year old Jeremy, that's.
Yeah, man.
That's mind blowing.
It's so funny that you had the record up there. That's awesome. The side 3 and 4. You grew up, you said, outside of Nashville?
Yeah, like Smyrna, Tennessee. It's 25 minutes out of Nashville. It's all kind of grown now to where it's just like one big city from here to there. But when I was growing up, it was the same thing as a small town.
Yeah.
And you had to come to Nashville to do stuff.
What was your childhood like growing up?
Very normal.
Very normal. I mean,
had MTV like most kids did. When I was a little kid, I played outside. I don't know. I had a very normal late 70s, early 80s existence.
Yeah. In small town USA.
Normal. My dad was military. My mom worked for the VA hospital. You know, they were both very, very supportive of rock and roll and letting me do what I wanted to do and needed to do.
That's cool. You're lucky that most military, I've talked to a lot of guys whose parents or dad was in the military in particular, and maybe was a little more conservative than they would have liked and wasn't as supportive of them playing music, especially rock
music. My
mom
definitely helped in that sense. But I mean, yeah, dad left me alone. I think back too, because I mean, you got to think that I grew up in the mid 80s. So I've got posters of all these guys that are super androgynous and look like chicks.
Yeah.
What he was probably thinking, like, what in the hell is going on?
Right, and, right. You
know, I wanted in. I wanted to be part of it.
Yeah. In the middle of the South there. I know. I get you. Do you have any other side hustles going on, Jeremy? Like either in the music business, doing things besides conventional touring, or outside of music completely?
I'm developing something right now. I can't really talk about it just yet because it's still in the planning and working out stages, and I feel like I'd be blowing my wad a little bit earlier. But the answer to that
don't
is
want
yes,
to blow
I
your
do.
Wad early.
Whoever follows me, you'll find out about it soon enough, sometime early 2020.
How do people? Where do you want people to follow you?
Let's see. One of my Facebook pages is maxed out, but I have another one that's like a fan page. It isn't Jeremy Asbrock. My Instagram page.
Just Jeremy.
You can follow me on Twitter. I don't really use Twitter as much as I do Instagram or Facebook.
Okay, cool. And everything's under Jeremy Asbrock.
Yes.
Asbrock for everybody listening. What were some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them?
Okay, being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 31, that was definitely a life changer. While it was a low point and a dark point, it also taught me a lot about the human body. And it also, I learned how to cook really good as a result of that. You know, there have been some positives that have come out. And now, like, the further I get into my career and the attention that I get, you know, I can bring awareness to that.
Yeah.
I guess a low point was when the Shazam ran out of steam and I didn't really know what I was going to do. You know, luckily, you know, Philip was around and he and I just kind of started playing for fun. I mean, he had a gig. He was playing for a country artist and just wanted to play some cool rock and roll for fun. And, you know, so did I. We were friends and it just made sense. And, you know, that evolved into the rock and roll residency. And the same with Ryan, you know, like I'd gotten a divorce and I literally met Ryan 2 months before that was final. And I was on the Kiss cruise 2 months after that. And, you know, I didn't just join a band. I had a new family and that all worked out perfectly. And, you know, and with that particular situation, I'm remarried and I have a child and now I'm in the right situation.
Yeah. Man, that's
so. Man, that just means that like the low points aren't always low points. Sometimes they're just learning experiences.
Yeah, you got to look at it like that, man. You have to. Couple of things. If you're comfortable talking, if you're not, that's totally cool.
Sure, absolutely.
I thought when you get adult like onset diabetes, it's type 2. but I'm not. What is the?
That is normally the case. You know, it is just a really strange thing to be diagnosed at 31 with type 1, because you do normally get that when you're a lot younger. That's why it's called juvenile diabetes. Or you get it over the age of 40, and you know that's type 2. Man, is my white blood cells just decided that my pancreas was a foreign object and attacked it and killed it dead.
Wow.
There's not anything that causes that. And if there is, they don't know what that is yet. But, you know, it just kind of is what it is.
And you control it now by diet. I'm assuming maybe some meds if you need it or whatever.
Yes, I take insulin.
Good for you.
But, you know, it's diet also.
I was at NAMM. Sorry, I mean to cut you off, but this was really interesting. I saw a couple of people. I was in the gym, and they had these little metal discs on the back of them. Are you hip to those things?
Yeah. So I don't have one on now, but I usually wear a thing right here, and then it will communicate with my phone via Bluetooth, and you know I can check my blood sugar anytime I want, and you know it has all these graphs and all this stuff just to track it and really keep an eye on it, and then you know you and your doctor can look at that together and you know determine what you need to do.
I thought that was
some of the other discs great. You might have seen. You know, people wear insulin pumps.
No, it was that. It was both cases. It was the measuring tool.
And I don't really do the pump yet. I mean, generally the place where you attach the pump is on your stomach and the fatty tissue there. But I play guitar, so and you know,
you don't have too much fatty tissue, I don't think either, man. I don't.
Even when it looks like you have a rock solid stomach, there's still a little bit of fatty tissue there that, you know, you'd be able to do that. But since I play guitar and it's high energy rock and, you know, you're performing as well, it just, I don't think it'd go very well. So yeah. I'm still using insulin pens.
Yeah. The thing about that little device that I thought was amazing is this one woman would explain it to me. She said, I used to take a shot of insulin in the morning, and then a few hours later, I'd feel like crap. But I realized because of this monitor that my biorhythms, my natural pattern is I might have a dip in the morning, but 2 or 3 hours later, there's a bump. So it allowed me to reduce my insulin only to the minimal amount I need to carry me through the next 3 or 4 hours. And I'm saying, man, what a great, I mean, that's changing people's lives, man.
It's very tricky, and it is not an exact science, and it's constantly changing too. I mean, it's not like there's some magic formula that you discover and then you just follow that formula. It's always evolving.
So you always got to monitor because your body's changing all the time. Yeah.
Always.
But at least you get there's something like that as opposed to just, you know, I'll have to do this regardless, and you can make adjustments. I thought that was great, man.
You know, and I even thought about, you know, guys like Brett Michaels who've had it since he was a child. And that means that, you know, he had it in the late 60s and in the 70s before all this technology came along, and how hard it probably was to manage diabetes then. And then like when he started touring in the mid 80s, you know, the technology still wasn't there. Like, you know, when I perform, I usually keep my phone in my pocket, and occasionally I'll look at it just to see where I am on stage.
Interesting.
And you know, they didn't have that luxury then.
Yeah, man, for sure. Good for you, man, that, I've been through a divorce many, many years ago, but, that you went through a divorce and 2 months later, that really was very fortuitous, man, because going really through a divorce was. Sucks. No matter how much you hate the marriage.
It was supposed to happen that way.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be where I am now.
Yeah, right, right. That's what I'm saying, man. I'm glad it all worked out for you. Very cool. Tell me a couple of things that you might have done that were sort of like out of your comfort zone at the time, but they turned out to be big breakthroughs for you.
Joining a cover band. You know, like I said, I always thought I was going to be in my band, and I was only in Shazam, and that was all I did. And, you know, I just needed to make money, and Philip had been done a couple gigs with this cover band, and, you know, he's like, hey, you want to do this? And, you know, he recommended me, and I needed the money, and that was the first cover band I was in, and I never thought I'd do anything like that. And even at the time, I was like kind of resentful and hated it because I didn't want to be in a cover band. But then it did so much for my guitar playing and my singing that it was pretty much the best thing that could have happened to me. And then it made being doing the rock and roll residency a lot easier too. Because while we're a cover band, or while we do whatever we want, we're still a cover band.
Yeah.
And just the effect it had on me as a player, hang on, I lost you. There you are. Was invaluable.
Yeah, I think that's a lesson for, like, every, myself included, everybody listening, that, you know, sometimes there's something good there. You may not, like you just said, sometimes the things aren't obstacles. They're like, they're ways of opening new doors for you, but you just don't look at it. You just don't know. You got to be open-minded to things. And yeah, what a good career you've got.
Yeah, I hated it at the time. I'm like, I don't want to be in a cover band. This is stupid. And now, yeah, it was one of the best things that happened to me as a musician.
Very cool.
Because like my catalog of songs that I know is, I mean, people have asked me like, how many songs do you think you know? And I'm like, man, I have no idea. Thousands.
That's a huge asset.
And it made learning songs a lot easier because, you know, that is kind of like a muscle. And I remember like that first batch of songs that I learned, and there was like 22, 25, something like that. And it's like, oh my God, this is so hard. My brain is having such a hard time processing this. And it's all like famous songs that, you know, that every cover band plays. And now I kind of laugh at that.
That's cool, man. Music. Tell me some of the top two or three best concerts you've seen.
Man, there's something about the first Van Halen show I went to. That was the first show I went to without my parents. My older brother took me. They oversold the arena. It was the 5150 tour. And I mean, I still remember that show. I don't even know how good it was really, but my memory of it is still just mind-blowing amazing.
Is your brother a musician?
Well, not really. He grew up playing drums, but had no interest in being in a band.
Right.
And we would play in the house together, and that was actually a very good thing for me as a musician, too, because yeah. I grew up playing with a good drummer, which gave me good rhythm also. Paul McCartney, the very first time I saw him, that was, I mean, that's probably the greatest show that I've been to still. And, you know, there's a lot that would compete for third place. You know, one of the many Kiss shows I saw. I saw Plant and Page on their first tour when they got back together for No Quarter. That's
pretty fucking
Plant's,
cool. Man.
Plant still had the voice. You know, that was really good. And honestly, I saw Queen this year, and that's one of the best shows I've seen. Man,
this year?
So good.
Really? Yeah. Now, all these shows were in Nashville that you saw?
No. Actually, Paul McCartney was in Atlanta. Queen was in Atlanta. Plant and Page was in Memphis. The Van Halen show was here. The best Kiss show I probably saw was when they did the first reunion tour, like the first tour they did. And by the time they made it to Nashville, everything was dialed in, and that was good. The first time I saw Kiss, I was 7 on the Creatures of the Night tour.
That's wild. And who took you to a concert at 7?
Well, you know, like I said, I got my first Kiss record when I was 4. I didn't even know bands toured, and Mom told me, hey, we got tickets to go see Kiss in concert. I just didn't understand.
Wow, your mom is so cool.
Yeah, well, that was the last concert they took me to also.
Were you out of control?
You know, my parents are cool, but they're not like cool. So we sat in the back of the auditorium, and that's where the stoners hang out, and they didn't know that.
The stoners hang out. There's stoners everywhere in a concert, man.
Yeah, but they really hang out in the back row. And I had strep throat, and we didn't know it. She had to pick me up from school the next day, and it turns out I had strep, and I don't know. Somehow that was the concert's fault. Or maybe not. I don't know. I had to wait for my brother to turn 16 before
you went to another show. That's funny, man. Hey, let's talk about gear for a minute. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Well, I've been working with a company called Vintage.
Oh, yeah.
A couple now, and I use a V100, which, you know, is shaped kind of like a Les Paul. For a while, I was just using, you know, the standard two pickup thing, but now I'm doing three pickups because it looks cool.
It looks really cool. So, what is that, like a five-way switch? What kind of switch is on there?
Just the same switch that's on a Les Paul.
On a regular?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
He's got it set. I have it wired, so there's a volume knob for every pickup.
Okay, there's a volume knob.
And if I put it in the middle, then I can kind of dial that in. I'm going to be honest. I kind of just use a bridge pickup.
Okay. Okay.
Occasionally, I'll use a neck pickup. You know, if we're doing residency shows and, you know, the song has that particular sound. But, I mean, most of the gigs I do anymore are with Ace. And, you know, Ace plays the solos. I play rhythm guitar. So,
yeah,
I really don't do anything fancy.
Gotcha. Gotcha. What other two guitars round out your top three?
So, like I said, I work with Vintage. And, you know, they kind of make a model of everything. So, you know, there's a Strat shape model too. And I mean, it's basically just like using a Strat. One thing that I do like is I like having the finish taken off the back of the neck. I like a natural wood feel. So I've had that done to all of my guitars.
Okay. I'm just sorry. I want to close my eyes because I've played guitars like that. What do you like about that? Just the feel of it.
I like the feeling of it.
What kind of fretboards usually use? Maple, rosewood, ebony?
Well, I like maple on the Strat style guitars. But you know, rosewood on the Les Pauls.
Right.
Man, I'm not really that picky about stuff like that. I'm definitely not a nerd when it comes to guitar. I don't know how to work on a guitar.
Right.
And it's just such an individual thing, you know, like you pick up a guitar and play it. Does it feel good to you?
Yeah.
It might feel good to you, but feel terrible to somebody else.
Totally.
I don't really push for any particular thing. It's all whatever I like.
Yeah.
I used to really like Firebirds, and I played a Firebird for a long time. Like when I did the Motley 94 tour with Karabi, I was leaning on a Firebird then. In the Shazam, I played a Fender Esquire reissue for about the first half of that. And I had a Gibson RD, a 1977 RD.
And what does that look like?
Kind of like a weird Firebird.
Okay.
Kind of a curvy shape like that. It's sort of like you just molded the Firebird a little bit. That was my main for a long time. And honestly, I always kind of imagined that being my guitar, like, you know, the SG is to Angus Young, like where if you pictured me, you would picture that guitar. And I don't know. I kind of got over that.
Yeah. Interesting. That's funny about I played one with a neck that was, you know, the gloss was taken off. I liked the feel of it, but I wasn't used to, it's tougher to move up and, you know, you got to get used to that. To moving up and down, it doesn't just slide, obviously.
Yeah.
But it did feel, I like a tactile, you know, like I like that feeling, but I just wasn't used to it. That's cool, man. So, okay.
That's why it took me so long to get used to Les Pauls. I didn't have my first Les Paul until 2013. And it was how hard it was to get up and play on the upper side of the neck because, you know, there's no horn here. And
yeah.
So it was kind of hard to get up there. And then I discovered the 60s classic neck, and I don't know, the particular one that I fell in love with made me a Les Paul guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I like a thinner neck myself, man, to be honest with
now
you.
Now I kind of rarely play anything else.
But your Les Paul, but the V100. Best guitar and best amp you've ever played?
Best guitar. That's tough, man. There's no best guitar. The Les Paul, the actual Gibson Les Paul that I own is fantastic, but so was my 77 RD. there's no best. It kind of just depends on what tone you need. You know, a Les Paul might not be good for a particular song, and a Strat might not be good for a particular song. Same with amps, man. Like, you know, I had a 79 Marshall JMP that was fan-fucking-tastic, but that might not be the right amp for a certain song. I had a 67 Princeton Reverb that might have been a better amp for a song. I really don't buy into a lot of the best this, that, and the other, you know, or anything, gear or music or anything. I mean,
yeah. No, I feel
other like than the Beatles, they're the best.
Other than the Beatles. Tell me your, do you remember your first record you ever purchased? Oh, that was at this Kiss Alive record. Sorry.
Yeah. So that was the one. And then, after that, after I discovered that I love Kiss, you know, mom took me to Kmart and I got the very first Kiss record. And that was like the first album with the cover that, you know, we paid full price for. But yeah, man, this right here.
That's it, man. That's so cool that you have that sign. Tell me your top three Desert Island discs. In no particular order, just for now.
Yeah, I saw that on your thing. Well, first, I'll have to go with the White Album because there's two albums and it's got more songs. So just because of length,
yeah,
I'm going to go with that one.
You could pick a box set, man. It's all good.
I would probably do Alive 2 by Kiss because that was like kind of the first one. And I can still feel that feeling when I hear it.
It's funny. Guys your age always go for Alive 2. Guys my age, which is like I'm a little about 10 years older than you, go for Alive 1. Yeah. It's really funny.
I think Kiss were the better band on Alive 1. But just because of my age and it being my first, that's the reason I'd have to go with that. I would have to go with something by The Who because The Who was actually the second band I ever discovered. My brother told me they were the loudest band in the world. And they had an HBO concert coming on, you know, like that month or something. I'm like, oh, I have got to see that. Probably 1984 by Van Halen, not because it's actually my favorite, but it was my first Van Halen record. And it's kind of like Alive 2, man. I can be 8 years old when I hear 1984. And, you know, just feeling like, oh my God, this is the greatest guitar player on the planet. Like Ace Frehley's good, but this guy is from another planet. And actually, something that I found way later in life, probably framed by the sensational Alex Harvey Band. Like that.
Interesting, man. I almost had him here on the show, but it was hard.
Who's Zal Clemmensen?
Yeah, Zal. Yeah.
Man, he's so good. Like, I fell in love with them.
Great player.
Wow, it's actually been a couple years now, 10 years or so. But, man, their music is so diverse. There's a little bit of everything, and there's a lot of theater in it.
Very much. Yeah, he's a good player, man. All right, tell me the best decision you ever made.
Best decision I made. I've got two of the best decisions I ever made.
Awesome.
Musically, the best decision I made was to stop thinking in terms of just being in my band and welcome in, you know, any situations that present themselves to me. You know, it'll help you grow as a musician and you'll move a lot farther and you won't stay boxed into this one idea because that might not be where you're supposed to be. And, you know, you may hinder your growth. And, you know, getting married to my wife,
right on,
having our son.
Are you open-minded like that in other areas, or has that experience made you more open in other areas?
'Cause
that's a pretty big turnaround.
I'd say, you know what, man, I'd say kind of the experience, 'cause, you know, as you had asked me earlier, if I had any other endeavors going on, and I do, and it's, you know, it's pretty big and it has nothing to do with music at all. And, you know, that was like some of the stuff that I got from playing with Gene.
Good for you, man.
To open your mind. that you don't necessarily have to have your hand only in the music box. So
good for you, man. No, the question was, did that experience suddenly realizing that, wow, I'm so glad I became open-minded to this because it changed my life. Has that made you more open-minded in other areas of things where in the past you might have? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good, man. That's really great.
Like I said, I thought I was just going to be in my band and you know, you make records and they go platinum and you tour and, you know, and then you're in that cycle.
Yeah. Make a record, go tour for a year and a half. Make a record, go tour for a year. Yeah. Very cool. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
That I'm very positive for the most part. I have a good attitude even when shit's going wrong. I don't freak out a lot. I like that about me. I'm not very judgmental. I have a real live and let live attitude. I think that helps in any aspect of life, whatever path you're pursuing.
Yeah, life's tough enough running your own fucking mess, let alone trying to worry about what someone else is doing. Like
I'm a very, very loyal person and loyal friend. You know, I've been best man 5 times.
So. Have you really? Yeah. That's pretty unique, man. Yeah, that's really cool. Wow. That is real. I've never heard that in my life. That's really
and
good.
Let's see. Two of those marriages are still together.
I was just going to ask you. That's about, I'm spilling my coffee. That's about the record. That's about what it is. 40%, right? Is that about how many people stay together in, right? That's pretty crazy. Flip side. What if you could change one thing about yourself? What would that be?
I saw that question, on your list of questions and I thought real hard about that, but man, I'm very happy with where I am. If I changed anything, then I might not be here. I might be somewhere else and, I wouldn't change anything. So there, nothing, everything that I did wrong, I learned from it. And if I changed it, then everything would be different. I don't want anything to be different.
Right. You know what, man? I feel the same way. And, I think I'm officially going to retire this question actually right now. For that reason,
has anybody actually given you an answer? Like, you know what? I would have done this.
Yeah. I don't always ask the question, but I have had lots of answers. Like, I wish I was a common one is I wish I wasn't so hot tempered, or, I wish I could relax a little, you know, versions of that, you know, I wish I could relax a little more. Sometimes people say I question a decision I made years ago about taking a certain gig and I often wonder what would happen. But by and large, the answer to that question is no. So I'm officially retiring because as you said it, I feel the same exact way. And I'm like, man, I shouldn't be asking that question. So, you know, thank you. You've helped me officially retire a question, man. Who's had the biggest influence on you, both musically and also personally?
Well, musically, I'd have to tie Gene and Eddie Van Halen. You know, Kiss got me started on the path. You know, Ace also, because Ace was the guitar player. I wasn't able to differentiate the difference between bass and lead so young, so it was just those two guys that I was drawn to. So they're kind of one to me. And Eddie, because, you know, like Gene and Ace made me want to play guitar, but Eddie made me want to be a good guitar player.
Sure.
And personally, I've had a lot of those. My mom.
That's nice. That's good. That's good. Tell me the most important thing she taught you.
To support your children in whatever they want to do. That mainly, and you know, the amount of love to bring to the situation.
That's nice, man. Is your mom still around?
Yeah.
That's great, man. Is they still live in that small town?
No. My dad, he still lived in the same house. He passed away in September. My stepmother still lived there, though. Man,
sorry about that.
Oh, man, it's okay. It's just life. None of us get out of that one. And my mom lives, you know, about an hour and a half.
You're right. None of us get out of that one. That's going to be your quote. You know, I always put a quote that someone says at the top of their interview. You just gave me yours. None of us get out of that one. That was great. But I am sorry for the loss of your dad.
That's okay. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Cooking. That's my hobby. Like I said, you know, when I was diagnosed with diabetes, I suddenly learned how to cook because I needed to eat healthy. And it just, you know, that along with, you know, starting to watch Food Network just helped me develop this interest in that. And now it's like my relaxation go-to.
Number one, the chef house. Number one hobby for musicians.
Yeah.
Cooking.
Well,
yeah. Pinch of this, a pinch of that, man. Tell me the favorite place you traveled. I know you've been all
Japan.
Over.
I love Japan, man. The food's amazing. The people are great. Cities are really clean. I've been there about 3 times now. I dig it a lot.
That's one of the top answers for that. I see videos.
All musicians say Japan and South America because the South American audiences are just off the chain. They are rabid crazy.
Australia is another one I hear.
Yes, I loved Australia too. I've been to Australia twice now, but honestly, man, I didn't really get to see much because all the shows are back to back, and so there'd be a late night, and they're so spread out that there'd be an early flight, and then you get to the city and go to sound check and play the show, and then leave the next morning, and I've barely got to see any of the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting about you said about the cleanliness when I'm from New York City, which is not the cleanest place, obviously. And I look at the train stations in Japan, and you can like eat off the floors.
Yes,
I'm like, why can't
it's amazing?
It's so
and
cool.
Honestly, man, they're way more crowded than the New York subways and train stations too. You literally have to shove people in to be able to fit one more person in, and they're still super, super clean.
This amazes me, man. Why can't we do that shit here?
We can, we just don't.
I know, man, but it's like I don't think people, I mean, if we went into, you know, Rockefeller Center or any other train station, you know, or Grand Center, and we polled people and say, hey, just curious, would you like this place to be really clean or filthy the way it is? I'm sure everybody would say clean. So like, it doesn't make any sense, man. You know,
in New York, they can say clean or fuck you.
Yeah. 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 They can say that too, man. That doesn't bother me. Funniest thing that's happened to you on stage or in studio?
On stage. Let's see. Sorry, I'm running through my head.
No, it's all good, man.
I've had some embarrassing things happen. Like, I don't know, part of the rock and roll residency is, you know, Philip and I are bouncing back and forth, you know, because we have to talk to the audience and we're both guitar players, and that was something that we both had to develop along the way. And, you know, you make jokes and stuff, and sometimes the jokes aren't that funny, but it's, you've already said it.
It's like, it's like playing a bad note and stopping.
I'm sure I've busted my ass on stage before.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's funny. If you and Philip don't look alike, but you look similar, like if you said you guys were brothers, it would be very believable.
Man, we get that more than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I could see that.
Like, but, you know, we both have blonde hair, so.
Yeah, blonde hair, guitar players.
Same age, you know, I get it, I understand. And yeah, like we get that more than we don't.
Hey, two more questions, Jeremy. Best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
I don't know who it would have been, but whoever suggested that I just seize opportunities instead of boxing myself into just being in this band.
So you probably spoke to somebody when it came time when you had the
honestly, I can't remember who it would have been, but you know, when I was struggling with the Shazam and I only thought the Shazam and I thought that was the only thing I was going to do, and somebody, you know, suggested that I broaden my horizons a little bit, and you know, I did, and I'm here today.
Right on.
I think the first time I pulled my head out of that band and did something else. Do you remember that movie, That Thing You Do?
I do remember that. Yeah.
Well, the two guys that wrote most of those songs wanted to start this thing called the That Thing You Do Review. And that was like one of the first things outside of my band that I did. I played a gig and a rehearsal with them.
In England?
No, it was here. They lived in Nashville. And that was the first time like, oh, well, that was okay. Playing with some other musicians and playing some other songs.
Right. It's hard though. I give you credit because that's all you knew. Cause you had been with that band since you were a young kid. That was like your like your second family kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know. I guess it was a little different then, like, you know, since it was easier for a band to become successful and get the record deal and go on tour. I mean, like now I don't even know what that is. But that seems so hard now. Like the whole concept.
But you know what? I've had so many guys come on the show and say these words. I thought getting a record deal was great, and it turned out to be the biggest nightmare I ever had. A guy who comes to mind right away, and I'm pretty sure you know him, is Brian Young.
Oh, yeah.
Great player.
I don't know him, but I know who he is.
You know who he is. And I remember I've had so many guys say those exact words verbatim, and it turned out to be like, you know, one of those be careful what you wish for things.
On one hand, that's also like, I guess a minor regret is that I never got to have a record deal.
Right.
But at the same time, I am where I am, so I don't regret it that much.
Sure. Totally get it, man. Hey, last question, and just thank you for everything. Thanks for being such a cool guy.
Thank you. Good time.
Biggest change in your personality over the last 7 to 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much is just a natural process of aging?
There hasn't really been that much change in my personality. I do take pride in the fact that, man, I've been a pretty consistent dude my whole life. I guess if anything, just that I'm more welcoming of different types of opportunities or different types of gigs than I would have been 20 years ago when I thought I was just going to be in my band and that was going to be my whole life for the rest of my life. You know, as far as my like personality, I'm still pretty laid back.
Still the same loyal. Dude.
I haven't really changed that much visually or my
visually, man, you look the same like you did when you were 25. You told me you were 25. I wouldn't have really batted too many eyelashes, to be honest with you.
Even high school, man, maybe a little less hairspray.
Yeah, man. Jeremy, listen, thank you so much for your time. I want to tell people where they can find you. First of all, if you're on social media, hit up Jeremy on Instagram and on Facebook. It's Jeremy Asbrock, Asbrock. Also, if you are in Nashville or visiting Nashville, he's part of the Rock and Roll Residency. They have a show coming up on March 14th at the Mercy Lounge in Nashville. These guys are a lot of fun, him and Phil. Really nice guys.
You can find us on social medias also.
The Rock and Roll Residency has a... Yeah. Great. On Instagram and
Facebook and Instagram.
Great. Awesome. So check out the Rock and Roll Residency on Facebook and Instagram if you want more information about that. And you can also go back and listen to Philip Schaus's interview as well. And again, March 14th at the Mercy Lounge in Nashville. These guys are really talented players, man, and they've honed their craft really well, and you'll have a great time at the show because they're good entertainers too. They've been around the world doing this with the best. So anything else that I could promote or that you want to talk about?
Ryan and Phil and I call ourselves the Talisman because we can't call ourselves the Ace Frehley Band or the Gene Simmons Band. We sell cool t-shirts. You can go to our individual social media pages and find out how to get those.
Right on. Support
they
these guys.
Killer too. We all have Pick Pack trading cards that we sell. Those are kind of fun to collect.
What are they?
Pick Pack trading cards. Like there's a trading card, you know, with our photo.
And yeah. Like a baseball cards.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
And then, you know, there are picks on the inside of it.
Oh, Pick Packs. Okay. I get a PIC yeah. Pick as in guitar. Okay, cool. That's awesome, man. And that's all on your individual social media.
Yeah. You can find all that there and just follow the links.
Very cool, man. See, I'm glad you promoted. There you go, man. That was good, man. I feel better. I always like to support my guys. Hey, man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate it. Let me say goodbye, and I'll wrap up with you. And thank you so much for your time, man.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Jeremy Osbrock for spending time with us. Please hit him up on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and also The Rock and Roll Residency. Buy his t-shirt, buy his pick packs, and anything else he's got for sale, man. Support everybody who's kind enough to come on the show. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Jeremy, thank you, brother.
Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.